Welcome back to Observations for Our Time. You know, as I read the newspaper each morning, there's part of me that wishes we were still doing Shattering Myths, because there's just so much that is falling apart in our world that we need to be commenting on. And there's another part of me that says, you know, it is really a welcome reprieve not to have to read 12 newspapers every day and wallow in the muck of mankind's mayhem. But boy, is the news bad.
It's pretty frightening.
You know, and you look at America in this presidential race, you know, I want to tell you, if these are the five best that America has to offer, we ought to just give up. Let's just fold our cards, fold up the card tables, fold the chairs, stop the band, and
give the land back to the Indians.
Give the land back to the Indians, because it isn't worth it.
I tell you, one of the problems is that people don't seem to get it. I talked to a lady who's spent her whole life in the banking business, and I was trying to explain the central banking system and fractional lending, and she had no clue.
No, not even a clue what what fiat money is, or how it works, or the fractional reserve banking, where if somebody deposits at $10, the bank is entitled to loan it out tenfold.
Yeah.
So that they can loan out nine of your $10, and then that person they loan it to, when they deposit the loan, they get to loan out nine of that $10, and when they then that person deposits it, they get to loan out nine of that $10, and pretty soon they have lent out, not all, 10 times the amount of money that you actually deposited. Then they created the Federal Reserve as a central bank, which has no money, and it is not a bank, and it does not have a reserve, and it's not
the money it didn't have that it loaned you.
Right, it's not federal, and their goal is to create the illusion that the banks are solvent, so that when people ask for their deposits out of a bank that doesn't have any money, in fact, is nothing but debt, that they can provide currency for that bank to create the illusion of solvency. And, of course, it's gotten so bad now that America is a house of cards, so nobody wants to buy T-bills. And recognizing that with a $20 trillion debt, the service on that, if the interest rates, we're just 5%, then the federal budget deficit doubles from $1 trillion a year to $2 trillion a year. And if it was 10%, then it triples. And it becomes, our deficit becomes an added deficit, grows at $3 trillion a year. And so to keep from having to borrow money at a rate that people would actually loan it to America to finance America's debt, they couldn't do it, and they couldn't afford to offer that kind of a rate. So they created the illusion of quantitative easing, where the Fed creates money out of thin air, which dilutes the value of your current savings, and then charges an interest on the illusion of money they created, so that the Fed becomes the largest holder of U.S. debt. Now, how do you like that for smoke and mirrors?
Well, I want to not loan you any money and have you pay interest to me on it.
Oh, you know, that'd be like, you know, when my son would go to work with me. I mean, he was grown up at 4 years old. His favorite thing, he would love just to, he didn't have a kid's backpack. He had a briefcase. And when he'd go to work, he always wanted to make big money. And sometimes when I didn't pay him as much big money as he thought he should have, he drew pictures of money. And what the Fed is doing is essentially creating the illusion, drawing pictures of money.
Yeah.
And loaning those pictures that they have painted out as if it was real money. Now, if you were anything other than the Federal Reserve, they'd put your sorry behind in jail as a counterfeiter.
Certainly.
I mean, what they're doing is counterfeiting. It has exactly the same effect of counterfeiting. It is counterfeiting.
Well, isn't the old rule you're supposed to fake it till you make it?
Very good.
Yeah. Speaking of fakes in your sports show, you should be having a field day with Johnny Manziel.
I have a strict rule. We don't talk about people. We don't do the TMZ angle. Johnny Manziel is not in sports right now, so I'm not
talking
about him. I will talk about Kobe Bryant, though, this week, but for not the reasons that everybody else is.
Oh, yeah, Kobe Bryant, the man who got by with rape to become an NBA hero. Yeah, he's a shining example of what a guy for the world to be worshiping as a sports hero. Or even look at probably the most revered football player, Peyton Manning. And if you read what happened in Tennessee when he sexually abused the female trainer, and what his best friend testified actually happened that day, versus what old football player himself, Peyton Manning, has to say, I mean, it's just repulsive. You know, and maybe the reality is that with stars and with politicians, you know, the five concubines of Ted Cruz, that what we're seeing is average America, what America has become, you know, in Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and Sanders, who's never held a job in his life, never done anything trying to dictate how America is going to be run economically. And you have these broken people paraded before our eyes, and maybe they really do just represent who we are.
Well that's really
they don't,
true.
They don't represent who I am. I should hope they don't represent who you are. But I do think they represent the average person. All these people that you mentioned, they get thrown in onto a pedestal, and they get they're basically revered for the longest time. You just heard how great Peyton Manning was.
Yeah.
Now I've never
and such a good guy. Everybody rooted for him. You know, like Brett Favre, everybody rooted for him.
But I've never been one to put. I've never been one to put sports stars on a pedestal because, one, I've been around sports my whole life. I know how athletes are. And number two, I don't know them. You know, I know them for what they do for a job, but I don't know them.
Right.
And I don't want to – I mean, that's not somebody that I need to be like. So,
no, but it's it is perverted. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting is that I was translating Isaiah, and there was a – section of it where it's talking about the location of Zion, and I really wanted to track it down. So to track it down, you have to deal with what God had to say with Dodo David, when you do that, and then you look at Solomon, and you look at Yahweh's relationship with Dodo, and later with his son Solomon, and you consider their behavior from a sexual point of view. And oh my goodness. I mean, they were really warped boys. But the difference is their sexual promiscuousness is never spoken of. God really just doesn't care about it. What he cares about is who you are, what you care about. What you have chosen to do vis-a-vis the relationship with him. So, I think we have a problem in sports that the person is made into a hero and marketed because that's how they make their money, with these endorsements. So we create this idea that this is success, and then when we find that that the people we have built up have feet of clay, we're disappointed. But, from Yahweh's point of view, the sexual promiscuity is just not something he focuses on or cares much about. Has almost nothing to say about.
in the passage we're going to do today, it's very clear what he focuses on, even though he uses a metaphor of sexual promiscuity. He's certainly not talking about sex.
But he's not talking about sex. I mean,
about religion.
Correct, yeah. He's going to use the metaphor of a harlot, a whore, in this section we're going to deal with, and yet there is no reference whatsoever to sex. The whore is actually represents an individual and an institution. Mm-hmm. The individual being Satan and the institution being religion, and particularly Christianity.
Right.
So even when he uses a sexual metaphor, prostitution, a whore, he's not talking about the physical act. He's talking about the covenant being a marriage vow, and most people choosing to
break the relationship.
Yeah. Sever the relationship by having an affair with someone else. And that someone else is almost always religion. Well, this begins as you would expect a father to begin. It says, my son. And when it says my son, it is most always Yahweh in first person speaking to his covenant children. Now, there's lots of people that think, you know, they're so focused on their Jesus saves, that they want the son always to be their Jesus. Now, of course, there is no Jesus. There is a Yahusha, but there really is no difference between Yahweh and Yahusha, other than Yahusha is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh set apart from him into our physical six-dimensional world. But almost universally, my son in the Proverbs is Yahweh speaking to his covenant children. So my son, literally and continually observe my words, my answers and my promises. This is from Amir. Especially my instructions and conditions for participating in the relationship, mitzvah, electing to continually store them up within you as a genuine treasure. Now, as fatherly advice goes, that's about as good as it gets.
Absolutely.
So you want to know what God's will is? For you to observe his emir. That's his words, his answers, and his promises. Where would you find Yahweh's words, answers, and promises?
In the Torah, Providence Films.
Yeah. Full stop.
There is, where else would it be? Joshua quoted a lot of it, but you couldn't find it all there.
Yeah. You know, Yahweh said that Yahusha, he would put his words in Yahusha's mouth. So, whose words did Yahusha speak?
Yahweh's.
Yeah. And almost always, what Yahusha said was either directly citing something from the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, or paraphrasing something from the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, or explaining what was written in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. So, you want to know what Yahweh said, you want to know where his words are and where his promises are, you'll find them in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Now, from God's point of view, by the way, Torah, Prophets, and Psalms sounds like three different things.
No.
And in them, we're talking about the first five books of what Christians would mistakenly consider the Old Testament. And those are the books that Yahweh dictated, the first four of which he dictated to Moshe. Yahusha happened to be there at the time. He's specifically listed as being there at that time. But he, over 40 days and 40 nights, he dictated this to Yahusha while they partied and drank and ate and all of that sort of good stuff. Probably didn't trash the house like in the case of Johnny Manziel. But they had a good old time up there. And then when they came down, because it is Yahweh's style, he had Moshe interpret and explain and quote and cite in context and apply what Yahweh had said in the first four books to the people, and that became Devarim, words. And this is followed by the book of Yahusha, and then the judges, and Shamuel is, of course, one of the judges. And the judges, in the judges, there are prophetic statements, as there are many prophetic statements in Samuel, and then that transitions into the histories, which we call under the Psalms in the sense of writings, in the histories, which are Chronicles and Kings, for example, of which there is lots and lots of prophetic, is both a lot of prophetic testimony. And the prophetic testimony isn't all future prophecy. There's past, present, and future prophecy, because prophecy, from Yahweh's perspective, includes history. And then from there, we move into the books that we just consider to be prophets. But in all of those books, the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, there is prophecy. In all of the books, the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, there is writing. And all three, Torah, prophets, and Psalms, there is Yahweh's teaching.
And so there's the history in every one of them.
Right. So they're really, they are that's a singular thing. Yahweh's word is singular. He has many words that are in his word. He has many answers, many promises. But it is one whole cloth. And the whole cloth is comprised of the Torah, the writings, which include the Psalms, and the prophetic books. And he says, my son, literally and continually observe. He uses shamar there. Does shamar mean obey?
Not at all.
Oh. When it says, does observe mean to obey?
Nope. Mm-hmm. It means to observe.
Right. You know, there are two jobs where observation is paramount. One is science. You perform an experience and you observe what happens in the reaction or during that experiment so that you can test whatever hypothesis you have laid out. But observation is essential to science. The other is this job that's done by old golfers called art.
Yeah, the visual arts are kind of tough to do blind.
Art. Art is all about observing and then conveying what you have observed into using a variety of different medium or implements to create an impression of what you have observed. And you have to observe the lighting and the perspective and the colors and the textures and all of those kinds of things, the shapes, the relationships between things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, art is I think one of the reasons that you have an affinity for Yahweh's testimony is that an artist has to look at all the shadings, all the colors, the relationships between everything that's in the scene, and has to come up with a way of pulling it all together to understand it before they can put brush to canvas.
Right.
It's all about it. Yeah, it's all about observing. So he says, observe, shamar, my words, my answers, and my promises, emir. Now, there is a Hebrew word that is the primary word for just word. So if he wanted to say just word, he would have used a bar.
The bar, yeah.
Yeah. Imra is just promises. And so if you want to convey the trio, the words, answers, and promises, then emir would be the right turn. So observe the declarations that I have made, the proclamations that I have avowed, my intent, my call, my responses, my thinking, my thoughts, the things that I have spoken, the answers I have provided, and the promises I have made. Then he says there's one set of these that are particularly important for us to look at, and it's the mitzvah. If you really study the word mitzvah, what you come to is it's you strip it of all of the religious heritage that taints our translations. And the mitzvah are the directions and terms of the mutually binding contract, the codicils, if you will, of the covenant. It's
the heart of the agreement.
Yeah, the heart of the agreement. It's the instructions and conditions for participating in the relationship. And, you know, in the heart of mitzvah, you have the letter, the Tazdeh, that is the letter that begins Sion. Sion does not begin with a Z. It begins with a TS. At the heart of this word, you have the TS. Anytime you see the TS, you should just be alerted, this is a sign. This is
signpost along the way.
Yeah, Sion is the signpost along the way. Sion does not depict a mountain. You know, to try to say, that is Mount Zion. You know, the mount that they call Zion in Jerusalem has nothing to do with Yahweh's usage of the term Zion. You know, his Zion is on a mountain But the mountain his Zion is on is Moriah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the signs posted along the way. It's the directions so that you know the proper way from man to God. But when you see that in the middle of the word, as you do in Mitzvah, you should be alerted that there are instructions here. There's guidance here. And in the case of Zion, the most famous of the TS words, although Eretz is a pretty famous TS word, that's the land itself, is Eretz. In all of these words, you find guidance. So, Mitzvah, directions and terms of his mutually binding covenant agreement. That's the thing that he wants you to focus on. Electing to continually store them up within you as a genuine treasure.
Now, let me ask you one quick question. Uh-huh. All of those, because a lot of people are also trying to translate. When you mm-hmm. when you go through so many of the English translations, they miss law. They use
right.
law. They use
right.
keep.
For Torah. Mm-hmm.
They use yeah. They miss the mitzvah altogether. They don't
yeah, they, it's always commandments, isn't it?
Yeah.
My commands.
But
what's interesting, though, is, of course, that almost all of the words that are most important to Yahweh, misfot, for example, they make it judgment, so it's judgments. And then Torah, they change to law, and mitzvah, they make command. And, you know, when you're dealing with free will, you can't have commands.
Yeah, marriage vows aren't commands.
No. No, you're not commanded
this,
into a family.
You're giving this to me. I mean, it's free will.
Right. Yeah, you don't get commanded to go into a home, to be part of a family. This is all free will. So it's, and, you know, the Torah, he specifically tells us that the Torah is based on Yara, teaching and guidance. And matter of fact, and the passage I just was working on before the show began, he talks about out of Zion will flow for the family, the Yara, the teaching, and you will find this in the source, which is his Torah. And it pulls it all together for us. So mitzvah is instructions and conditions for participating in the relationship. That's why it's so important. That's why he wants us to focus on it. That is a subset of his answers and promises and words.
Mm-hmm. So my question to you was, even if you were doing just the simplest translations,
uh-huh.
when you look up all these words, you just write them down, get the numbers, go to several right. sources, what you've described in yours is exactly what you'll find there, maybe not written as eloquently, but you can look up all those words and there's nothing contradictory about what you've written and what you find by looking them up.
Except one thing.
Why didn't
except
they
one,
get
except,
that?
Except one thing.
Uh-huh.
And that, the one thing is that there are lots of words where the lexicons will provide where the first definition in the lexicon isn't a definition, but instead a justification for the King James translation.
Yeah.
And the King James translation was not actually a translation. It was a... it was a scheme. Yeah, the Geneva Bible correctly pointed out that God does not endorse governments, and that the endorsement of government and therefore the legitimacy of kings to rule over people was not godly. And so King Iams, James, and his Rosicrucian supporters, his satanic supporters, and Francis Bacon et al. Were tasked with with creating a official, authorized Bible that would legitimize the rule of the king. And so that's the purpose of the King James. And all it really did is it is a revision of the Geneva Bible, which had become so popular. There really was no translation involved to create the King James.
There's more twisting.
Bible, just simply a restating and a bit of editing to the Geneva Bible. And the fact is, they did not have a single Hebrew scholar. Then there was no Hebrew text. The Masoretic text did not exist at that point.
Right.
At least we didn't have any access to it. The only really credible Masoretic text is the Codex Leningradus. It wasn't even published
11th century.
Until, yeah, well, it was written. It may have been written around the 11th or 12th century. It wasn't published until the 19th century, so no one had access to it. And so it was not the King James is not a translation of the Masoretic text.
No.
It's not even a translation of anything in Hebrew. And the Bibles that it revised weren't translations of old Greek manuscripts or of Hebrew manuscripts, but instead of various translations of the Vulgate, which was a Latin translation of the Greek.
Yeah.
So you're dealing with lexicons that are trying to justify extraordinarily bad religious translations many, many times over and almost never of the Hebrew. So they were translating Greek to Latin and then Latin to English in an environment where the church controlled everything. And so that's why you ended up with uniformity on mitzvah being a command.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're going to translate and you want to be accurate, you have to look beyond the religious influence. Now, as you say, all of the information to write instructions and conditions for participating in the relationship, it's all there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the explanation of the word they get to right after they've tried to finish their justification for the existing translations.
But you'll find what you're writing there.
Yes.
I mean, I know I can't pick at what you've translated because I can find all that without really going that deep, which is very encouraging to me, but and very sad for anybody who proclaims they're a preacher or something like that and said this is what it says. I mean, they obviously didn't look.
I don't see. You see, I don't think preachers do any of this. I think that the preachers that make an attempt to explain what a word means in their sermons are always trying to explain a word that Paul chose to use,
and therefore
they're dealing with Greek.
Yeah,
and they've been
a priori point of view that Paul was actually an apostle saying something worthy of.
Right. They weren't schooled in Hebrew. They weren't schooled in Hebrew.
Yeah.
And I want to tell you, being schooled in Hebrew might even be a liability because you would have a tendency to convey the language as it has evolved as opposed to what it originally was.
Yeah. I do agree with that. It's tougher that way.
Yeah, exactly, because the only way that you can really effectively create a accurate translation is to remove the influence of the Masoretic 11th century diacritical markings and vowel pointing, because there was no reason to vowel point. There are five vowels among the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, so there is no reason to vowel point, and so the only explanation for doing so is to shape the words to convey what was in the interest of rabbinical Judaism. And so you do need to take the time to pull back the layers of that, which is not hard to do because, you know, the lexicons do provide, you know, you look up any word, it will show you every word written with the same letters. Therefore, prior to the vowel pointing, and you can, you know, it just takes you a little more time.
Yes.
But you have all of this material is available to you.
Yes.
You know,
no excuse.
You know, no excuse, except you've got to want to do it. Now, the part of this that strikes me is important because I've said so many times, I think the single most viable thing in the universe is the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And God is saying here, treasure up my words, my answers, and my promises as a genuine treasure.
Yes.
So that affirms the conclusion I've had for some time. The other thing that I think is interesting is that when Yahweh returns, the first thing he's going to do is write his Torah inside of his children. Right.
Yep.
And so what he's telling us, you know, that we could do much worse than following his example. And just because his example in this case is in the future the very fact that he has made it known to us in our past means that we can follow his future example. And so since he's going to write his Torah inside of us, shouldn't we try to do the same thing?
I would think, the best we could.
Right, and that's what God's saying. If you do that, if you follow this advice, and you continually observe Yahweh's words, his answers, and his promises, especially his instructions regarding the conditions for participating in the relationship, and elect to continually store them up within you as a genuine treasure, there is nothing that you can't achieve. There is no obstacle that is too high. Nothing that is impossible for you to accomplish, including obtaining eternal life.
Well,
it's all there, laid out before you. And you shall genuinely and continuously live. Yeah, so what's the first thing that God says is going to be the result of you observing his testimony? You're going to continually live.
Eternal life.
Now, he is being a bit presumptive here.
Mm-hmm.
He is saying, Kirk, that if you closely examine his answers, his promises, his words, and especially the conditions and instructions relative to the relationship, that if you do that, you're going to continually live.
Well,
now, what he's assuming here is that anybody that prioritizes this and actually does this is going to understand what he's offering, then they're going to want to act upon it, and they will act upon it.
Right.
That's what he's presupposing here, is that his offer is so well laid out, so genuine, so beneficial, that everybody who takes the time to appreciate who he is and what he's offering will capitalize upon it.
And that's what makes Dode so acceptable in his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody prioritized it was him.
Yes. Exactly. Dode did this. And, you know, Dode had, I looked at Dode's first six sons. They were from six different mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And then he moved to Jerusalem, and you know, he had three or four of them from the same wife at that point, but he was still having sons from multiple women, and they didn't even include in the number of sons the sons from concubines.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And he's not even an athlete.
Yeah, but not even an athlete. But from Yahweh's perspective, what matters is if you observe, closely examine, and carefully consider his testimony, that you're going to understand what he's offering, and you're going to respond appropriately to the covenant. And I think he's right. I don't think there's a person in the universe who could closely examine and carefully consider what Yahweh is offering and not capitalize upon it. So what that means is that the scholars, an Old Testament scholar who is a secular humanist or religious in nature, that
call them twisters of words.
Yeah, that they aren't closely examining and carefully considering. They aren't observing. That has nothing to do. They're playing the scholarly game, the education game. I'm going to get tested on this, so I'm going to learn what I have to know to get tested on. Yeah. To join the club and pass the test and tell the teacher what the teacher wants to hear. But if you're willing to genuinely observe, closely examining, carefully considering everything Yahweh has to say, particularly about his covenant, then this is going to be the result. You are going to live forever. By closely, it even says here, you shall genuinely and continually live, Chaya, by closely examining and carefully considering my directions and conditions of the binding relationship agreement.
Mitzvah.
The mitzvah. No, there's five terms and conditions for participating in the covenant. And each of those terms and conditions is actually a benefit for us. Walk away from religion and politics.
Right.
Walk away from your country. Is the first. The second is to trust and rely upon Yahweh.
Yes.
Yeah. The third is extremely important. It's to walk to Yahweh to become perfect. Yahweh has, you know, it's one thing just to walk away from religion and politics, but Yahweh has a very specific path. Zion is the markers along that path that we walk from our polluted, corrupt world to his, to his perfect home.
Yeah.
By way of the seven Moed Mikre. So you walk to him and become perfect. That's the next one. Next one is simply observe the mitzvah. Shamar mitzvah. The same thing he has said here twice.
Mm-hmm.
Shamar mitzvah is the fourth condition. And the fifth is, as parents, we're asked to circumcise our sons on the eighth day. Because that sets us apart. It's our signature. It's the sign of the covenant. It's a tangible way we can show that we've accepted these terms and conditions at the point of the where we conceive new life, where we consummate a marriage and conceive new life.
Right.
So, and you shall genuinely and continuously live by closely examining, carefully considering my directions and conditions of the binding relationship agreement, the mitzvah, and with my Torah teaching in accordance with the center and focus of your eye.
Right. And that's not hard to prove either. I don't know why. Apple's only found in King James stuff.
Yeah, you know, there is absolutely
nothing
here that would suggest Apple.
No.
The Ishon is absolutely unequivocally the center or pupil of the eye.
And it's
no fruit here. No fruit. No apple, no fruit.
It's even from Aaron, you know, enlightened, free will, enlightenment.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay. Ishon, which is individual enlightenment of free will. It's a compound of Ish and Aaron, enlightened free will. Ish is individual.
Yeah.
It's how in the world they got Apple make that. But by the way, I'm sure they don't even write Torah. There, they either write teaching, because they know Torah means teaching, and in this case, writing law as the apple of your eye would make them look stupid. So they probably actually translated, well, they weren't even translating Hebrew, but they probably wrote teaching, but the word there is Torah.
Yeah.
So, where are you going to find the mitzvah?
You're going to find it in the Torah.
That's exactly right. And so he wants his Torah to be in accord with the center of the focus of your eye.
Mm-hmm. Which is the pupil.
Pupil, yeah. So focus on, pupil. Yeah.
So you wouldn't miss it.
That's exactly right. You know, if you're staring right at it, that's what your focus ought to be. Then, in fact, you're observing.
Yes.
You know, it's really hard to observe a written text if you're turned even 30 degrees from it. You've got to focus on it. Choose to fasten them unto your fingers, and of your own volition engrave them on the tablets of your heart. Once again, that's what Yahweh says he's going to do. He's going to write them on the tablet of our heart when he returns. He's saying, this is be a really good thing for you to do. Now, heart in Hebrew, does heart mean the organ that pumps blood, or does it mean your seat of emotions?
Person. It is the real you, where you make decisions, where you...
Yeah, as a matter of fact, emotions, the seat of emotions in the ancient world, including in, amongst the Hebrews, was the kidneys.
Liver.
Yeah, okay. liver, kidneys, that part of the body.
Yeah.
That was the seat of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
The seat of reason was your heart.
Thought and understanding, that's the heart.
Yeah, that's the heart. It's where you process information so that you can render
make
a good
decision.
Judgment. Yeah, make a judgment. So that you'll make a moral, reasonable, rational, impassioned, careful decision. And so the information that you take in there becomes literally part of the fabric of your life, which you can use then to as an experience to rely upon and as a proper perspective to respond appropriately. You know, a lot of times when you're in a difficult situation, if you don't have a prior experience of, so you recognize what the challenge is, there's no way to respond quickly enough to it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you write the Torah inside of you and you inscribe it on your heart where you make your decisions,
yes,
then
dunk.
Yeah, when you're confronted with something, you're immediately able to respond.
That ain't right.
That ain't right.
I didn't filter through, no.
No, that ain't right. Yeah. Exactly.
And that's why, you know, what you said so many times, it's a few programs ago, was we don't hate enough. I mean, how do you confront the things that we're confronting in this day and age and getting worse in the next 10, 12 years and not understand this is, you should be, your back, the hairs on the back of your neck should stand up. You should say, wait.
Right.
You know, how do you process that if you don't?
Yeah.
Do
when you're reading things about the Pope, and you, like Bernie Sanders, is off to the Vatican because he wants to have a meeting with the Pope because he wants the Pope's, you know, credibility. Because, yeah, they're both communists. And so, you know, they're going to get along just famously. And so he wants the Pope's blessing. And it just makes you want to puke because you know that God doesn't have a church. God despises a person of that kind of esteem. As a matter of fact, when he returns, one of the things right after he talks about, you know, his return, he says that he uses three different words to talk about elitist, high-ranking individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, first thing he's going to do is vanquish them from the earth. And the second thing he's going to do to them is diminish them.
Yes. We know how that works.
Yeah. So they're going to be, they're going to go from a three-and-a-half-dimensional construct in a six-dimensional universe into a singularity. Where the only dimension is time, and God's very specific about these individuals. So if you know the Torah, you know that who's lying to you, and you're angry at them because people are being deceived. So you know God's coming back. He is in a foul mood.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing he's going to do is judge and condemn, wipe out, vanquish, judge and condemn. He's going to clean house. He's got 5 days to get the world back to the conditions of Eden, to rid it of religion and politics and militarism and cut those hideous shrines to Satan on the Temple Mount.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one of the reasons I wondered how in the world could God ever place his home on top of the site that the Dome of the Hoofy Print, the
that resonated
Dome of the Rock.
Could have been instead of, obviously, he can't do it there.
He's not going to do it there.
It just is too dirty.
Oh, way too dirty. He's going to crack, you know, he's going to have an earthquake fault that's going to go right through the Mount of Olives, due west from there, and those two mosques and the Temple Mount that is with its wailing wall where the Jews bob their head up and down and where the Romans were going to build the temple to Jupiter and I think they actually did, and where the two satanic mosques and shrines to Allah are built, and immediately on the other side of it, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, all going to be swallowed by the earth.
Yay.
So choose to fasten them onto your fingers. Why do you think that he uses fingers?
That's what you bind with, I think. It's the extension of the hand.
The fingers in the hand are the hand in Hebrew is the symbol of your actions, your power, your influence.
All right.
That's always the hand.
And
so it's what you do.
Yeah.
You know, your direction in life, where you go is your walk, your feet, and what you do once you get there is your hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wants us to walk correctly, so we're walking in the right direction. But then he wants us to have his instruction guide what we do.
And
that's why
the hands, right with it, so forth and so on.
Right. Yeah, the heart is so that you can make good decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And the hand is so that you can do the right thing. The feet is so you can go the right way. So elect to say, and this is now Proverbs, which is a Marshal, 7, we've done 7, 1, 2, and 3. This is Marshal, Proverbs 7, 4. Elect, and by the way, when I give the numbers, I'm always uncomfortable with the numbers because there aren't any numbers in the text. Yahweh didn't provide numbers.
No, it's a continuous thought, but
yes.
A series of thoughts. But you still, you know, for the rest of us old folks out there trying to figure this out.
Yeah, the only advantage of giving the numbers is that you don't have to ask, where are you now?
Yeah.
So, you know, you can look up the Hebrew in Proverbs 7:4, and you can verify what you're hearing. Right. That's really the only reason for giving the numbers, is so that somebody knows where you're getting it from, because the numbers do not exist in the Hebrew text. Elect to say, there's a lot of free will here. This is written in the imperative mood, which is the second person volition. Elect to say, of your own free will, choose to express to wisdom. So elect to say to wisdom, which is shakba. You are my sister and my wise friend, whom I know, whom I acknowledge and recognize. You should choose to call and summon understanding.
Right.
So there is this myth that God is interested in what we the level of our faith, our devotion, our conviction, the content of our heart, or whether or not we think about this, that, and the other thing. What God is saying here is that if you want to know Him, if you want fatherly advice, observe so that you know, and think so you understand. He's saying wisdom here. Wisdom is correctly associating and describing evidence to the proper standard, so that you have an accurate perspective from which to evaluate everything that you're witnessing.
Right.
That's wisdom.
Exactly.
So I like to say to wisdom, you are my sister. You know, wisdom, you're part of my family. You're kin.
Yes, what you embrace.
Right.
You should embrace it.
What you come to understand is so vital to this relationship. And my wise friend, whom I've come to know and acknowledge, you should choose to call upon and summon for understanding. So as you know, to know a lot of things doesn't necessarily help anybody unless you can make the connections, unless you can assess the information accurately. And so God is saying that knowledge isn't necessarily the end all. Knowledge isn't the one that you summon. Knowledge isn't the one that you associate with. It's understanding.
Right. Well, what do you do with the knowledge if you can't put the pieces together?
Right.
I mean, do you any good at all? You still have to discern the difference between this and that and figure out what he's asking.
So we need to, as people, if we're following Yahweh's advice, observe his testimony so that we come to know, make the necessary connections so that we come to understand, and then summon that understanding, rely upon that understanding. That is what will put us in the right place with God.
You know, I observed two things when I was doing this that I thought were kind of funny. You know, I asked myself, I made a little note down here, where do we get wisdom? And obviously it's from the Torah, the Ruach Kodesh, and Shema. Mm-hmm. All of them are feminine.
Right. Yeah, they all are.
You know, like the set apart spirit, you know, Ruach
right.
Kodesh.
Right.
And Yah obviously has no issue, unlike Paul and Muhammad,
right,
in describing his greatest assets as feminine attributes.
I
know that kind of.
Yeah. In fact, Yahweh as a name,
mm-hmm,
is feminine.
Feminine's got H on the end.
Yeah, it's got the hay on the end, right?
Yes.
You know, if the son becomes daughter by adding the H to the end.
Yeah.
Brother becomes sister by adding the H to the end. A male individual becomes a female individual by adding the H to the end. Fire goes from male to feminine by adding the H to the end. You know, Bana to build the family home. It's got the H on the end.
But you're not going to have that perspective from churches.
Or... No. You know, Yahweh is all of Yahweh's most endearing, most beneficial attributes
mm-hmm.
are feminine.
Yeah.
And the means that Yahweh uses to convey them, the Ruach Kodesh, set apart spirit, feminine. The Torah, feminine. Covenant. Bereth, feminine. Family, feminine.
Wisdom.
Yeah, feminine. Wisdom, feminine. Mitzvah.
Understanding.
Feminine. Yeah, terms and conditions of the covenant. Feminine, yeah.
Yeah.
Understanding. Feminine.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a... It's a reason for all of that. And that's why the adversary is depicted as a whore.
Yeah.
Because it's the counter to Yahweh's, Yahweh's feminine attributes would be a whore. It would not be a man, a masculine entity countering Yahweh's most meaningful and endearing feminine attributes. So that's why we have a whore. Speaking of the whore, as we go to the seventh verse, by being observant, you will be protected from the illegitimate, estranged, unauthorized, sickening, and repugnant woman. This is Isha. Ish is man. Isha is woman. Away from the whores, seductive words, and deceitful promises. You know, as Yahweh was talking about... And he opened this saying, observe my words.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the whore has her own words, seductive words. They're the religious words, the political and religious pontifications. So he's saying, by being observant, you will be protected from. That's the whole reason of being observant. You know, you are insulated, you're inoculated from the seductive nature of the whore, who is the antithesis of Yahweh. And this whore is religion.
Yeah. What it's described is flattering, smooth, slick words. I mean, that should give you a clue. And then there's a mar can also be a sickness as a break in the chain of the body. So, I mean, those are the negative attributes to the words. And
Chalak, I mean, seductive words and deceitful promises, her flattering speech and misleading answers which divide, errant declarations and avowed proclamations which are easy to swallow, the slippery slope to being divided, apportioned to another by way of their intended allotment and provisions.
Yeah, Shalakimur, right?
Right. So there is something that God's saying that the whore represents that is deceitful and seductive.
And it ain't sex.
No, and it's illegitimate, estranged, unauthorized, sickening, and repugnant. Yeah, it has, you know, there is, this is not sex.
No.
This is religion. In fact, it becomes really evident when you get into Yashayah, because as he talks about national revolt and national rebellion, he speaks of Jerusalem, where all of this was being manifest, becoming a whore.
Right.
And so the whore is depicted as descriptive of a nationalized rebellion from God, which could only be manifest in societal, religious, and political customs. So the whore is being equated to seductive words and deceitful promises, which are refuted by and are thus in opposition to Yahweh's Torah. As such, the whore is Christianity. Because this came out of, you know, the answer is my Torah, and the whore is lying and is illegitimate regarding the Torah. I mean, there's only one religion that takes the Torah and besmirches it. Christianity.
Right.
Pauline Christianity. Now, the whore is also Astarte, Ishtar, the queen of heaven and the mother of God. But where do you find today the queen of heaven and the mother of God?
Right in the Catholic Church.
Right.
And
the Orthodox Christian Church.
And the Orthodox Church. And to some degree, is well respected in the Protestant churches. They just don't make statues out of them.
Yeah. Exactly. The virgin and child. This is Astarte, which Yahweh says is also the whore. It's, you know, and her most famous, her most celebrated holiday, what was that? It's even the day, Easter.
Yeah.
Easter. It's even named after Astarte.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I was thinking of mother and child.
No, oh, and a mother and child, of course, is Christmas. Jesus. That's the second most. And
okay.
with the Queen of Heaven and my mother of God, and her most famous holiday is Easter,
mm-hmm.
the Christian holiday. She was part of a trinity, by the way, too.
Yes, she was.
With the Bel, the Lord, who was the Son, who impregnated her on Easter Sunday, so that 9 months later she gave birth to the Son of the Son. The Trinity. There you go. For in and by the window of my house, this is Yahweh speaking, through my lattice, denoting the proper timing of things, from a higher elevation, I looked down, and I saw her. And by her and with her were the simple-minded and the naive. And I made the connection, understanding and recognizing among the children a young man of deficient character who lacked judgment.
It's going to be real clear who that is, but the funny part is the simple, the naive, the, you know, I was one of those. So, mm-hmm. It ain't like I'm talking out of school here, you know, and talking right. Like somebody talked down. I mean, I was stupid.
I was one of them.
Blind and thinker.
I was one of them. And so God is saying, listen, I've got this house. I've got this family. You come to know who I am and understand how you become part of my family by observing my promises, my words, my answers, my Torah, you know, ascribing them to your hand, inscribing them on your heart. Focusing with the center of your eye on my Torah. And if you do that, you're not going to be seduced by the illegitimate whore. Now, he's telling you, I'm looking now out of my home. So what God is saying is that the whore does not have a home of her own. He's saying that the whore is not set up camp in an entirely different place. He's saying that the whore lurks outside of the covenant. That the whore lurks outside, but adjacent to his word.
And that's rational.
But what he's saying then is that if you want to find the whore, if you want to recognize the whore, don't look in some, you know, satanic occult ritual. Look at a religion who has corrupted and twisted his testimony, who has obfuscated his covenant as their own. So, what religion claims that it was inspired by the same God, but has a new covenant of their own, replacing the old one?
Christianity, yeah.
Right. Who put their Easter...
There's no one else I can substitute.
Who put their Easter right on top of Passover?
Christianity.
Right. Doesn't Christianity carry around the first 80% of their Bible? Isn't it the Torah, prophets, and Psalms?
Yeah.
So God said, I looked right out my window and through the lattice denoting the proper timing of things.
Right.
And from a higher elevation, I looked down and I saw with her, the whore, the simple-minded and the naive. I made the connection. Understanding and recognizing among the children a young man, a deficient character, lacking judgment. All right, so what you have here is the whore is establishing herself with religions that piled their rubbish right next to Yahweh's truth.
Mm-hmm.
So that, because Satan doesn't want to be worshipped as the adversary, Satan won't be worshipped as God. The only way that Satan can do that is to usurp that which is God, to place the lies right on top of the truth, so that it looks and appears credible. That's what Islam has done, where it takes its credibility from Dodd and from Esau, who they claim is Jesus, yeah, and from Moses, and all of that. You know, the same characters. They talk about the Torah and the Psalms and the Injil, the Gospels, and it tries to usurp the credibility of the actual God to make its lies appear credible. That's where the whore is lurking, and she's got a big crowd around her. Simple-minded and the naive.